curtain has descended across the country.
Today, our very freedom came under attack.
If young people do not see hope, what kind of message are we sending?
Welcome to the podcast. My name is Colin McEwen, and we are about to talk to a diplomat. Last week, we were with one of our junior research fellows, Matt Korda, talking about Ukraine. And this week, we are with Hassan Siddiqui. Hassan is our Expanding Community Program Editor here at the NATO Association of Canada. He is an Honorary Bachelor of Arts in Political Science and writes regularly for us about the Middle East and North Africa, Eastern Europe, and the Afghanistan-Pakistan region. Welcome to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Now, the first thing I want to ask, whenever we're chatting here at the office or in your articles, you have an exceptionally well-informed view of things, not just the general trends, but, you know, specific on-the-ground, first-hand accounts. Where are your sources? Where do you get your information from?
Well, generally, it's actually quite simple. Online internet is amazing, and more specifically, you gotta think outside of regular news sources. You have to go into Twitter, or actually a lot of people don't know, but Reddit is an amazing source of information. The amount of information, it's essentially you have to cross-check, you have to look at the links that people set, and you have to Google a bit here and there, but I mean, the Twitter and Reddit combination has been deadly when it comes to information exchange, and it's been pretty amazing in that sense.
So diving into the Middle East in particular, in the first of our editors' debates, the water cooler we call it, was about the progress of the Iraqi army, and you advised caution, saying that, you know, it was progressing militarily, but that this was overshadowing the underlying sectarian divides. Now, to what extent is this true in Syria with the government forces of Bashar al-Assad?
Between Syria and Iraq, there are two different animals in terms of when the Syrian revolution was beginning, 2011, it wasn't really instigated due to some sectarian strife between the majority Sunnis and the Alawites. Yes, there are naturally sectarian strife within any sect, be they Sunni Shia or whatever, but it was more so about general freedoms and human rights and abuses by a Ba'athist government, which is secular in nature. Whereas ISIS expanding in the Anbar province or Iraq generally, this was a direct reaction to the Shiite government, let's say, Shiite government, quote-unquote, being pushed by Iran and curbing down, let's say, on Sunnis. For example, the Americans, they set up groups like Sons of Iraq, which was Sunni pro-government militias who were fighting against ISIS back when it was still ISI in 2007, but they were dismantled by the government because the Shia government, quote-unquote, once again, saw them as a threat against the government itself. So, and the recent turmoil in Anbar, it's essentially a reaction to the sectarianized policies under Maliki, which the Iraqi government is still trying to rule from. And it's coming, it's better than before, but it still has a long way to go. So I wouldn't say that Syria has the same sectarian dynamics. It's a bit different, but there have been sectarian undertones now, especially.
And they seem to have vastly overtaken the initial more political hopes you described, you know, a democracy or civil liberties and whatnot.
Yeah.
Is there any, like, realistic hope for those left? Like, the original goals of
the
Free Syrian Army?
Yeah. The Free Syrian Army, when it started off, it was essentially the split from the original SAA, right?
The Syrian Armed Forces.
Yeah, from the Syrian Armed Forces. And they were still quite hopeful of general human rights and whatnot, and what do you call it, democracy, et cetera, et cetera. But as the conflict steadied out and it started pacing longer, you had radicalization happen. You had Jabhat Nusra come in. You had Dawla Islamiyah and the ISIS come in. And then you have Islamist groups. You have moderate groups. I think there's still room for the more moderate groups to be fighting and actually making a difference, because the FSA was very disorganized and disillusioned to a certain extent due to lack of support. But as of recent, they've established the Southern Front, which is essentially a conglomerate of 40-plus rebel groups working under an FSA banner. And they have revived, so to speak, the FSA. and you've had Islamist groups in the north who've changed the dynamics of the game again, because initially the Syrian Arab Army was on an offensive, but now after they lost Idlib, when Jaish al-Fatah, which was the army of conquest, was established by Turkey, Qatar, and Saudi Arabia, and they funded semi-moderate Islamist groups against the state, those really pushed the Syrian army back on its heels, and the dynamics of Syria have been changing, and these are very testing times for the regime, essentially. As of right now, I think it was either today, yesterday, that Israeli intelligence gave a report that the Syrian army is creating a line of defense which is 100 kilometers long, east of Damascus, to hold off the ISIS advance coming in.
So they're actually quite pessimistic.
Oh, they are very pessimistic. Essentially, what happened was, after Palmyra was lost, that the city which is known for its ancient structure and whatnot, it gave ISIS an open route to Damascus. So this line of defense, as per intelligence, is 80 kilometers east of the airport of Damascus, which is east of the city itself.
Right.
So you can understand how close the regime is feeling right now. Actually, Israeli intelligence is saying that Assad might have to leave Damascus and go to Latakia, which is more of like an Alawite stronghold, so to speak. Yeah, so I mean, it's a very tough situation for the regime now, especially from the south and the north.
Yeah, that almost sounds like a partition you're talking about. If the government flees to Latakia, and then the southern rebels end up taking Damascus, and then ISIS ends up taking the north and east.
Yeah, definitely. I mean, but the talk of Latakia separating as a different state of Alawites or whatever has been in the news for quite some time. At least people have been saying, oh, that Bashar one day will have to run off to Latakia and he'll create this pseudo state or something to defend himself. But these things have not been realized. The Syrian army has proven to be in capacity, thanks to its other actors such as Hezbollah or the IRGC, to hold off, let's say, complete annihilation of right. the regime.
Right. One thing that has been realized, which a lot of people were fearing, was the spillover of the conflict into Lebanon.
Yeah.
Between, you know, hundreds of thousands of refugees. I don't have the latest numbers. And now ISIS does actually have a very small foothold in Lebanon, and Hezbollah is fighting back, of course. Do you see the spillover escalating?
Oh, yeah, definitely. Because with ISIS in particular, what happened was, and this was the first time during this whole conflict, when ISIS attacked Hezbollah positions within Lebanon, which was on the border of the Kalamoun Mountains. And this was unprecedented because before, the rebels were fighting Hezbollah within Syria. But this just goes to show that for Hezbollah, this is turning into an existential crisis. So if they do not fight, if they do not hold off these groups, this is essentially a threat to their existence, because Nasrallah himself, many times now, has said that if Syria falls, Hezbollah falls with it, because Syria is a stepping stone for Iranian support coming in through the land. So if Syria loses out, Hezbollah automatically loses out. And ISIS's nature is not tied down to borders. If you remember, they do not recognize Sykes-Picot. So they will not stop at reaching the border of Syria and Jordan. They will continue in, right? And that's just their mentality. And because of the involvement of Hezbollah, overt involvement of Hezbollah in the affairs of the Syrian revolution, there's a lot of bad blood. And naturally,
of course,
they will come in, try to take revenge, essentially.
Right. Changing topics, one aspect of the conflict that gets, well, I would say disproportionate attention in Western media is the foreign fighters that trickle from all sorts of countries over to the region. Which of these, I should say, in some cases they're fighting with ISIS, sometimes they're fighting against ISIS, with the Kurds,
right,
or with the FSA. Which of these, in your experience analysis, has been the most active in making a difference, either numerically or, you know, the intensity or what have you?
Well, you have to understand that every side has a foreign volunteer sort of dimension to it. The Kurds have it, Hezbollah has it, ISIS especially has it, Nusra has it. Moderate rebel groups, FSA, are more Syrian based. They're more Syrian bred. They don't have foreigners coming in and fighting for them. Rather, they don't want that. They'd rather have the ammunition, the support. But the largest amount of foreigners who've come in to fight is naturally for ISIS, because then again, who counts as a foreigner, right? If you mean by Arabs, Nusra is a huge Arab population, right? And a lot of them are Tunisians, Saudis coming in, and they're fighting Jordanians. But from the Western world, so Europe, America, Canada, they usually go there and they join up with ISIS, because ISIS is especially marketed towards European brands of extremist groups and whoever supports them from the UK or Europe or France or whatever they may be. So, but you see Kurds also. Kurds have about 100 foreigners fighting right now for them against ISIS. Hezbollah has foreigners coming in from Pakistan, from Afghanistan, from Iran, who are essentially helping them fight against ISIS. And that's it's much more sectarian for a lot of the Shiite foreigners to come in. But they've been cases. It's all across the board. But the one that's highlighted the most and the one that is active the most is definitely ISIS, hands down.
It almost sounds like there's no real trend to draw from these, that it's so varied and so desperate that, you know, the hopes of governments to try and stop this is...
Well, the thing is, a lot of these people, especially ISIS, because, I mean, ISIS is a very central actor in understanding the mentality of the conflict, at least from an extremist perspective, is that they view this as, like, a coming of age sort of thing, you know, like they're motivated by theology, right? They have this warped understanding of their religion or whatever, and they sort of are trying to implement this. So their motivation factors are very different from everybody else's. And a lot of the rebel groups, such as the FSA and the Southern Front, even Ahrar Sham, and all these other semi-Islamist groups, let's say, or Islamist groups, or general rebel groups, they've set up ideas and intentions to offset ISIS, right? So you have groups like Jabhat Nusra, which is an affiliate of Al-Qaeda, right? And that itself has fought with ISIS, right? And they themselves work with more moderate groups. Now, I wouldn't say completely moderate, but rather moderate groups from the other Islamist groups. And they're working under the Jaish al-Fatah umbrella, and that involves countering a lot of the ISIS as well. So, I mean, it's become very unpredictable, the way that the rebel coalitions are working. But it's working towards, essentially, weakening of the state itself. And after that, weakening the extremist elements in Syrian society.
All right, there's just one last thing I'm going to ask. I ask this of all of our younger guests. Imagine, say, five or 6 years from now.
Yeah.
What is Hassan Siddiqui going to be doing? Personal life, ambitions, dreams, rose-tinted lenses, cynical realities.
I think I want to be involved with more towards intelligence or more towards defense on a state level or private, and just interested generally oriented towards the Middle East, Eastern Europe. I'm also very interested in what's been happening in the Ukraine.
Good catch.
I apologize for that. In Ukraine, because I myself am from there. I lived in Donetsk. I have friends there. I understand what the situation's happening. I mean, I write about the Middle East, but I also write about Eastern Europe.
Yeah, that's
we
did Ukraine last week, so that's why I'm from the Middle East this week.
So, I mean, just generally international relations. I mean, I want to study further into it, and I want to be a contributor towards knowledge in regards to the field.
Isn't that a very eloquent spin on a contributor towards knowledge? Well, on that note, thank you very much for being here.
I try my best. Thank you so much for having me.
Thanks for tuning in. Check out our website, natocouncil.ca, for previous episodes, as well as ongoing coverage of events every single day. You can also find us on Facebook, YouTube, LinkedIn, and Twitter, all of which can be found from our homepage. Next time, we'll be back with Tim Hewish, director of the Commonwealth Exchange, after a Commonwealth Defense lunch next Monday, to figure out what exactly this whole Commonwealth Defense thing really is, anyway. Talk to a diplomat. signing off.